The power of the supermarkets today on Bush Telegraph. We're bringing you a recent forum that we held on the influence that Woolworths and Coles wield in Australia and how farmers and shoppers can choose to live, work and eat without relying on the big retailers. This is an edited broadcast of the public discussion hosted by Bush Telegraph and run in conjunction with the Field Institute in Melbourne. Okay, welcome to tonight's forum. It's to discuss the power of Australia's supermarket duopoly and look at moving towards a more transparent food system, how we go about that. My thanks to the Field Institute for hosting the event. I'm Cameron Wilson. This is a broadcast for Bush Telegraph on ABC RN and also Radio Australia. So obviously we're discussing how much power Coles and Woolworths have and how that affects consumers and farmers. But the aim of tonight is not to get caught up on dwelling on how we got to this situation or complaining necessarily about the power of Coles and Woolworths. It's more about acknowledging that the big retailers do play a significant role in the Australian marketplace, and they're really likely to continue to play that powerful role in the future. So we're hoping tonight will be more about discussing what can and should be done for a more sustainable market for shoppers and a more informed market for shoppers and more sustainable outcomes for farmers as well. So the Field Institute has assembled a panel of experts in this area to help guide tonight's questions from you and discussion. So I'll start with an introduction of the panel. Dr. Charlie Massey is a farmer from the Monaro region of New South Wales, also a researcher with the ANU. Ewan McEwan, director of the Field Institute. Dr. Sharman Stone, Federal Liberal Member for Murray. Dr. Carol Richards from Queensland's University of Technology, also Vice President of the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance. Professor Christine Parker, who is an expert in politics, ethics and regulation of the food system at Monash University. And next to me here is Matt Purbury, who's a farmer from Grown and Gathered. So if I just start with getting you all to show your appreciation for the panel tonight. So happy to take questions. If anyone wants to get us started, just raise your hand and Freya will get a microphone to you. But while we're doing that, Dr. Carol Richards, let's start with a snapshot of the supermarket power in Australia.
Thanks, Cameron. We've got a fairly unique situation in Australia. We've got the most concentrated supermarket retail sector in the world. We've got between 70 and 80% of market share held by two major supermarket chains. If you compare that with other similar countries, developed countries like the UK, there's four supermarkets that have 75%. In Norway, you've got four supermarkets with about 99.9% of the market share. So there is a shift towards high concentration in food retail, but Australia is amongst the highest.
Charlie Massey, you're a farmer. Why does it matter if the two major players, two supermarkets, have so much power?
Well, I think it matters in lots of areas. I guess before I go in, if you like, with a microscope, I think the big issue for me as a farmer is we seem in this society to be living in parallel universes. From what I've just learned at ANU, next door to the climate and other scientists, the big issue confronting humanity is the fact that we're trashing the very planet that's sustaining us. And it's the big multinational companies and the retailers that are part of that whole drive, because it's all predicated on the assumptions of a modern capitalist system and economic rationalism, which does not include environmental and value systems in it. And so that's a big picture. To turn it around, I see it's not going to be politics, it's not going to be policy from, as far as I can see, other than information. It's going to be individuals in the way they buy food and farmers growing it in a different way and not an industrial way that's destroying the landscape and the food quality.
We'll delve into how that can be done very soon. But Christine Parker, how did we get to a situation where there are two such powerful retailers in Australia?
How did we get there? Well, some people say Australia's full of monopolies and duopolies, and it seems to be true. They would argue that we only have a small population, and so we only need a couple of companies for each good or service. But like lots of other areas, the big companies have been concentrating, increasing their market power, and we don't seem to have any competition law that has been able to stop them from doing that.
There's an article in the Monthly by Malcolm Knox, and he makes the point, we think of ourselves as local, but we behave big and corporate. Would you agree with that?
I guess so. I think it's the way that the Australian polity and society works that we do have some of these big companies running a lot of things, and that they do have the ear of those in government. And because we are not such a huge population, it's been a bit easier for some of these companies to really dominate politics.
How much access there is to government. Sharman Stone will know about this. If a company like Coles or Woolworths wants to get the ear of government, how do they go about it? What's the process?
Well, in the usual way, they just ring up the minister who interests them, whether it's for competition policy, at that point it'd be Bruce Bilson at the minute, or the treasurer. Because they're Coles or Woolworths or Wesfarmers or whomever, they have the ear of any government. They're so big, they're such huge employers, there's such huge generators of tax and so on. But I think we've got where we've got because we've got failed competition policy in this country. For example, the incremental growth of the market share doesn't count pretty much when you look at our competition policy, or doesn't ring bells. It's if there's a major takeover. As you know, at the moment, not to talk politics at you, but we're doing a competition policy review literally as we speak. It'll have its first draft out for public viewing in about September. But we have kidded ourselves, I think, for a long time that we're so well served by our duopoly because we get cheap, down every day, down prices. Well, so do the farmers. We get dirt cheap offerings of price for our product. And it can't work both ways. You can't squeeze your suppliers to death year after year and expect them to come back smiling with a beautiful product for your fridge or your fruit bowl. They go, and we're facing that dilemma right now.
How much responsibility should government take, either side of politics, for the fact that we're in this situation now?
Well, I think it is policy failure. I think it's legislative failure because other countries, we're particularly used to looking at the US with their antitrust provisions, we've allowed a competition environment in Australia. We've allowed a weak ACCC that's not done much for anyone. For a very long time. It's come good in very recent times, I think, with a new chair, a new CEO. Our anti-dumping authority is still failing. Our Productivity Commission, which runs the emergency safeguard actions, where you call for some assistance if you're being killed by cheap imports, which is a WTO-sanctioned measure that can be taken, basically says, get over it. You're going, you've been killed by imports. Yes, you are, SPCA, but, we're not going to do anything for you. So we have this extraordinary situation in Australia where we've got so many true believers that the market always delivers the optimal outcome for everyone. Well, that is right in theory, and I have a PhD in economics, and, 101 said things like that, but the reality is totally different. You've got to if you're going to have competition that is delivers the good for all, it's got to have total transparency in the marketplace, total information access, and you've got to make sure that there is no collusion and concentration of power building up somewhere. We don't have any of that, and yet in Australia we run around and tell ourselves, the market delivered that result, it has to be okay, and why would we intervene? Because we've got a level market, level playing field going on here. Well, I say the consequences of that are we're not going to be able to feed ourselves with locally produced stuff in the long term.
Is it all bad, though? Charlie, Sharman Stone made the point there. Consumers love this, cheap products. There are some farmers doing very well out of this system. Big producers, lucrative contracts with the big supermarkets. It works for some, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think, and without casting stones, but if a lot of that is productivist industrial agriculture, and you've got to question the value of the food that's being produced in that system. If you look at it compared to organically grown or the landscapes I'm dealing with, broader landscapes from holistic grazing and pasture cropping and stuff, they're chalk and cheese in terms of nutrient density. And so the big unaddressed issue is the massive health issue of the food that's coming through the industrial system, both from the way it's produced but also the over-processed food from, you know, the big multinational, they call them food producers, that's delivering the packaged stuff into the shelves as well.
Seems like a point that should be followed up, but we've got a question from the floor. Just get you to tell us who you are and direct your question to whichever panellist.
My name's Sophie and I'm studying food politics and policy studies at Melbourne University, and I'm here with colleagues from the Youth Food Movement and Centre for Sustainable Leadership. I guess my question is if we're the next generation involved in this, what do you want us to do?
Who wants to have a go at that one? Carol, Food Sovereignty Alliance, this is your
stuff.
That's
a great question, yeah. Reconnect with the food system, take control, find. I think we've all got to work a lot harder at our food. It's very easy to walk into the supermarket chains. They're everywhere. They've completely saturated the market. It's very difficult to find alternative outlets. And it's a lot better in Melbourne, where I live in Brisbane. It's increasingly hard to find a good alternative outlet for food. I think we've got to take up the challenge, not just the younger generation, but all of us, and actually put a little bit more thought into where we source our food from. Just think a little bit more deeply about it. And people are starting to, you know. We're really well aware about how far we've been disconnected from our food, what the ingredients are, what the provenance of that food is, who's grown that food, what kind of price they're getting, how fair is that food, and what are the animal welfare conditions behind that. So all of these things in lengthy supply chains with retail duopolies we lose touch with. So I think we've got to regain control, and there's fantastic ways it's happening. There's a very big food movement going at the moment. It's a little bit fragmented. There's all sorts, because it's building. There's all sorts of things going on. And what we're trying to do with the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance is trying to get that food movement flying in formation. And we've been so inspired by many amazing things that's going on. The youth food movement in particular, with their campaign about ugly food. You know, we have this obsession with cosmetically pure food.
Perfect.
And, you know, we know a recent study in Tasmania showed that 30 to 40% of food grown there is being ploughed back into the ground or fed to livestock because it's cosmetically imperfect. So we have to start reclaiming this space. Social media, younger generation, definitely got it over us oldies on that one. I think that's the space to...
Can I just make a comment, Cam? Yeah. On that point, I mean, so at the Field Institute, what we believe these people should be doing is... it's one thing being a consumer, it's another thing being an entrepreneur in this space. You know, like, we have duopolies because there's a lack of competition. And with digital distribution systems, with the enabling capacity of social media, you can have totally new kind of platforms starting up. So, you know, young people who are entrepreneurial, who can see the gaps and react to them and build communities around them, I mean, that's... Grown and Gathered is a great example of that. It's that actually builds enough capacity for an alternative supply system.
Yep.
I did just want to get a little bit more on the youth food movement for listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Thea from the Youth Food Movement in Sydney. I guess YFM is really about building the skills and knowledge that the young people have around food, and we very much are aware that young people are seen as supermarket generation, and that's something that we really want to address and get young people involved in the process of where their food comes from, and that means giving them a hands-on experience, not just giving them information, but getting their hands dirty and building their skills.
You're listening to Bush Telegraph, RN Radio Australia. It's a panel discussion on supermarket power and transparency. This is coming to you from the Field Institute in Melbourne, also exploring attitudes to food and how perhaps shoppers and farmers can go about changing a food system that they're not totally happy with. Question from up the back.
Hi, my name's Jackie Dee and I work in food education and have done for 15-odd years. My question really to everyone is, how do we go about educating people? Because number one, there's a lot of people who just don't care. Number two, there's a lot of people who, even if they cared a little bit, just can't afford it, as we said before. And number three, even if you sort of care, the reality is people are so busy that the local supermarket's just the easy, quick, fast option. shopping at a farmer's market every weekend is great, and I and my family do it, but it takes time, it takes dedication, and you still have to go elsewhere to get those other things that aren't available at the farmer's market. I mean, I just find it very encouraging that there's been enormous growth and change in this area, particularly in the last 5 years, but we've still got a long way to go. Any suggestions as to how we really get the message out there to make a difference?
Matt Purbury, we haven't heard from you yet. Matt's from Grown and Gathered. Have a go at that one.
I think you've just got to do it. You can't. I feel like when we grew up, we used to go to the butcher. I don't know if the butcher was any good, but we always went to him. And we'd always go to the bakery, and the bakery was incredible. I can vouch for that. I don't remember going to the supermarket to buy a lot of things. We definitely went to the supermarket. There was a local grocer when we were growing up. By the time I sort of left town and went to Melbourne for school when I was sort of 14, there was no grocer left, I don't think. And I think it was already changing. And now there's no butcher in town. There's no... Well, the bakery's still going. And we've sort of had to, as well, being in the country, track down the same thing that you have to do in the city. I think there's probably a myth that food's easy to find in the country. You just got to go and find it. You've got to have that energy and, I guess, maintain the importance to do that, I think.
Your story's quite interesting. The business is Grown and Gathered. Just tell us what you actually do.
So my wife, Lentil, and I grow veggies and flowers, basically, and fruits. So we grow very sustainably, very organically. It's a very small little patch. We probably supply the equivalent of maybe 50 families with their sort of groceries every week, but just their, you know, fresh produce. And yeah, I used to be a graphic designer. Lentil used to be a speech pathologist. And it's only been about 4 years since we've been doing this. And it's our life now. It's really fun. Like, I think educating people isn't the hard bit. It's getting them interested in the education. Like, once they're there, once you've got them, people are really interested in growing things and the whole process, because it's a really fascinating thing. It's a really exciting thing to be a part of.
So you're a graphic designer by trade. How did you learn to grow veggies?
I started, basically. I think it was just something I was interested in. I was a bit lost. Like, graphic design wasn't for me. And I'd been travelling for some time, and I just got more and more interested in people's gardens and what they were growing and stuff like that. And I found it fascinating that people could grow these things. And it always blew my mind that sort of the simplest, most humble gardens were the most productive. And I just started looking into it. I did an apprenticeship, but a very informal apprenticeship with an old local fella close to us, and sort of worked with him for nothing for a while. And then started working for another farm that grew organic food for some of the restaurants in Melbourne. So took it from there. And as I sort of started learning at those places, I started growing for myself, then met Lentil, and we started doing the flowers as well, and it's taken off from there. It's a really natural thing once you start, but you just got to start.
So who buys your produce?
The most incredible people in Melbourne, I tell you. They're all legends. It's awesome. We're finding just the most lovely people are attracted to what we do. It's really opened our lives. We used to sell to the restaurants solely, basically, a lot of different restaurants in Melbourne, and that was really fun. It was great dealing with the chefs, because the chefs are so passionate about the produce. But it's like that now, but times 50, because you sell to one chef and he serves 100 people, or you could just serve to 50 people. And so everyone's reactions and appreciation for the food and, you know, their thirst for education and knowledge about how we do it or what's going on in the farm is just, it's awesome. Like, yeah, it's a really fascinating thing for people, I think.
And this is every bit your business and profession now. You make the living you want
from doing this. Yeah, this is all of us, yeah. Yeah, everything we do.
Don't go without too much?
No, I think we're the luckiest people in Australia.
Charlie, this is a very new approach to, or new attitude to farming.
It's actually an old one, but it's okay, new. Yeah.
You're spot on. It's a very old one. It's new again, like that cycle we tend to see. When you hear Matt talking with enthusiasm, happy with what he does, there's a lot of older farmers around Australia that are the total opposite, sounding a little worn out, don't feel like they're making a living. Why don't they just change?
Yeah, that's the $64 question, which is actually, having been a farmer for 40 years who made a lot of mistakes, even though I was ecologically sympathetic, it's the question I asked and took me back to university to do a PhD. As someone said, rapidly trying to get my student card before the pension card. And what I looked at was... I looked at some of the innovators in what I call regenerative agriculture, the leading innovators in pasture cropping, grazing, that sort of area. And I interviewed 80, and about 60% of them had made... It's when you shift to regenerative agriculture from industrial agriculture, it's actually a worldview and a value system shift. It's
Can
major.
You define it for us, regenerative
agriculture? Oh, regenerative agriculture. I hate the word sustainable because it sort of connotes status quo, just holding steady. What we now know, if you farm in a healthy fashion, you can actually improve, you can bring degraded landscapes back to health. And it's open-ended in ecological systems terms. Complex ecological systems self-organise. And if you enable Mother Nature to get on with it, and a lot of these farmers said, well, my role is to step away and let Mother Nature, you'll find that you can actually improve landscapes. And they keep going. And anyway, my research showed that in about 60% of the cases, people had made this major shift because they'd had some major life shock. You know, burnt in a bushfire, poisoned with chemicals, marriage breakup. That seemed to open their mind to something new. And what that's telling us is that as we grow up in an industrial system, we don't realise how we just take on board. I did it as a farmer. And as consumers and all the rest, we don't realise how imbued we are with the accepted paradigm. And to get out of that, it's difficult. So the question up there is about education, and I think the youth movement answered their own question. It's about telling stories, because we've got a great story to tell. This is the biggest story. It's about saving the planet. And
but what you're saying, when we sit here and say, why don't farmers just extract themselves from the duopoly system and supplying Coles or Woolworths, we're actually asking someone to make a profound change in their life.
It's a big ask. And particularly, you know, I've been there, still carrying a farm debt. And it's high risk to make a big change because the phase into regenerative agriculture, there's a tough 4 or 5 years often. I've seen people are now 20 years into it have tripled production and halved their costs and stuff, but the phase-in period is the challenge. Yeah. And it's, as one farmer said, it's that square foot of real estate between our ears.
Okay, we've got a lot of questions to get to here. You're listening to a RN Bush Telegraph broadcast. It's a discussion around supermarket power and transparency. It's coming to you from the Field Institute in Melbourne. On the panel is Dr. Charlie Massey, a farmer from the Monaro region, a researcher at the ANU. Ewan McEwen, who is the director of the Field Institute. Dr. Sharman Stone, the federal Liberal member for Murray. Also with me, Dr. Carol Richards from Queensland's University of Technology and the Vice President of the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, Professor Christine Parker from Monash University, a specialist in politics, ethics and regulation of the food system, and Matt Purbury from Grown and Gathered. We've got a question up the back there.
Hi, I'm Declan. I'm from the William Angelis Institute. And my question is just to the whole panel, but with the decrease in welfare, how do we ease low-income families into paying more for food?
But there's a logical place to start, but I'm going to start with Carol Richards, if I could.
And buy crooked carrots.
How do we encourage low-income people to... I'm sorry, I didn't catch the end of the question.
To buy more expensive food.
To buy more expensive food. Oh, gosh, that's a real tricky one, isn't it? I think one thing we need to do is... because it is the idea that the supermarkets are selling cheap food and that cheap food is convenient. I want to dispel that myth. Supermarkets don't sell cheap food. They sell junk food. They sell highly processed, high sugar, high fat, high salt food. So they're not really... They're selling food that begins with a PH, is one of my... It's a kind of a hollow form of food. So I think one thing is if you want good food, then you have to invest in good food. In Australia, I think on average, we spend about 17% of our income on food, which is quite low. There is a problem for people on low incomes to get access to good quality food. I think you... probably need to be, I mean, this is a systemic problem. It's not a problem with people on welfare with low incomes. It's about access, availability and the supply of that food. I think there's a number of things opening up now. Shorter supply chains is a good way to go, so you're cutting out all the middle people. So relationships with producers, short supply chains, finding out some of the intermediaries around. And I just wanted to do a big hats off to the Open Food Network who are in the audience too, who have done a fantastic job in linking producers with consumers. You've got direct supply relationships. So part of the issue is about knowing, and it's hard to know with a system that's not very transparent. But I think there's a way forward, but it's not that clear at the moment.
You say you've got a bloke, couple of kids, works minimum wage, hard manual job, mm-hmm. gets home at the end of the day, wants to have sausages and mashed potato and a beer, doesn't want a slow cook pig's hooves? You know, how do you...
Pig's hooves used to be cheap. But I know what you're saying, and I think there's... I mean, we're on the brink of change, we're on the cusp of change, and again, the people involved in the Open Food Network, I'm amazed they're sat right in front of me and not here on the panel, but in terms of setting up food hubs, I mean, that's been set up to address this idea of being income poor, time poor, people in the commuter belt who travel long distances to work, spending a lot of time sat in cars, having car-based diets, which are not very healthy. It's just looking at alternative ways to link farmers and producers with some of those people on low incomes. And there's a way forward, and I think there's amazing things happening. So I would say Google Australian food hubs and have a look at the Open Food Network as well, a way to bring these groups together.
Professor Christine Park, I'll get you to add to that, and then we'll take a question from up the back.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think this question really gets at the absurdity of some of our discussion here and some bad assumptions we make that it's up to the consumer to fix the system. I just don't think that's right. So the question was asked, how do we get somebody on a low income to spend more on their food, as if the problem is with the person with the low income that they're not spending more on food, when really the problem is, A, that they have a low income, and there's been interesting studies done in the US on how Walmart, for example, it pays many of its employees less than welfare, and basically our system works on the basis that these big companies want to pay people less, don't want us to be taxed, don't want to be taxed enough to pay decent welfare. And if we ask questions about that, we can't ask questions about the food system without also asking questions about income inequality. Also, a number of the things that people have said today that could be improved are all things that, you know, government does still have a responsibility for. Matt mentioned the lack of, local shops that have disappeared, grocers, butchers. These are because Coles and Woolworths don't want these shops, and because they've been able to use their power to do that. So we've talked about too much processed foods has been, just the basic labelling law type reforms that have been brought in other places in the world were completely scotched by our government. So there's many things we could be doing that... as citizens we should take responsibility for rather than as consumers.
Okay, quickly, Charlie.
Just a quick point. There might be another way of looking at that good question. If we look at the Depression years and the war years, a lot of people were forced into self-sufficiency, and unfortunately we've lost a lot of those skills in how to grow your own food, but that is another way of approaching the issue.
Another question from towards the back there.
Hello, my name's Angie. I'm from Local Organics. We've been working for 4.5 years as distributors. We started because we got a taste of flavour, and we realised that locality was really important to flavour, and we changed our value from what looks good to what tastes good. We're at a stage where we're sort of transitioning to try to grow big enough to be sustainable as a financial organisation as well as just a community and awesomeness organisation.
You can only trade on awesomeness for a certain
for
amount
so
of time.
Long. And we do those things. We have bendy carrots, we have rubbed apples, and we are about accessibility and affordability, and we're doing those things. But it's sort of like the pressures of the competitive nature of the food industry just really seem to be pushing us so hardly on price. And, it's good to talk about Coles and Woolworths, and they're obviously, really top heavy, all the money goes right to the top, and they don't come back into the community like smaller organisations. But what do you imagine the scale of, we're looking at, what scale do we need to be at? And what do you, as a panel, imagine the scale of an organisation that does this sort of thing? What's good, like IGA, like we haven't talked about them, or other sorts of smaller grocery outlets?
Ewan?
I think that it's really important that we remember that, yes, you have big business can exist and dominate, but also that any system can be an ecosystem, and lots and lots of micro businesses can actually supply any. And you know, I mean, if you look at the Italian industrial model around the craft and design sector, it's lots of very small manufacturers. So, I mean, food can be lots of small businesses employing small numbers of people. It's a matter of having, you know, a good product, a good brand, finding a customer and surviving. But we should be trying to encourage more small food businesses and realising that they, over time, that's actually probably going to have more impact, more positive impact for the country.
Carol Richards?
Yeah, can I add to that as well? It's good for the economy and it's good for food, but it's also essential for food security to have a lot more smaller scale, diversified food businesses. What we've got at the moment is a situation where we've put all our eggs in one basket. And there's been a really good research happening in the UK, a paper called Nine Meals from Anarchy, where they've looked at the just-in-time logistics that supermarkets operate by. And if there's any disruption to supply, like a strike or fuel, I mean, we're facing the crisis of peak oil, that there's only nine meals, basically 3 days' worth of food, in the system that you can access from the average supermarket. So we've put our eggs in one basket. If we've got something like a drought or a flood that we've had recently in Brisbane, the supermarket shelves are empty and there's no food in the system and people are panicking. So we've not got a very secure system as well at the moment. There's no resilience built into this market concentration.
Matt Purbury, I'm guessing you'd last more than nine meals.
We would last a few more than nine meals, yeah. Well, us and our community, and I think that's another thing that's lost, is we've lost that community about all your, you know, knowing who your different growers are.
I want to keep getting through some of the questions if we could. This is a Bush Telegraph, RN, Radio Australia, broadcasting a panel discussion on supermarket power and transparency and the food system more generally from the Field Institute in Melbourne. The panel guests are Dr. Charlie Massey, who's a farmer from the Monaro region of New South Wales, Ewan McEwan, director of the Field Institute, Sharman Stone, the federal Liberal member for Murray, Carol Richards from QUT and vice president of the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, Christine Parker from Monash University, who teaches in business regulation and lawyer ethics, and Matt Purbury from Grown and Gathered. We've got another question from the floor.
Hi, my name is Linda Cheng. I am a former employee of Ewan's. We've heard a lot of discussion tonight around the supermarket system as a way of innovating our food system. But I just wondered, in a discussion about the power of the supermarkets, and obviously with that power they can use it for either good or evil, whichever they choose. I wondered what the panel would think about the possibility of innovation from within the supermarket system in order to achieve all of the things that we have talked about tonight, such as regenerative farming practices, equitable prices, and more engagement with our food provenance.
Charlie Mess.
Yeah, I don't think you put the fox in charge of the hen coop. Because what we're talking about are companies that epitomise the worst of global capitalism. The big escape clause is maximising shareholder value. So to look for... I mean, the big issue is we have a broken system, and tinkering with it, especially if you're asking the foxes to do it, isn't going to change it. And I think the... I guess maybe it's my experience in wool marketing and breeding sheep, you know, ethically... without millsing and stuff, and seeing the functioning of cynical politics and multinationals makes me a bit sceptical. I really think the power of the individual, the farmer, as Matt was talking about, reconnecting with consumers and an education process from underneath, particularly with health as a hook, is the way we're going to re-empower a new system. And as Einstein and others have said, the thinking that's got us in the mess today, that same thinking won't get us out of it. We need new thinking and a new approach and a new story.
But Charlie, haven't we seen Coles in particular react to consumer pressure? Now, people argue whether phasing out sow stalls is a good or a bad thing, depending on your perspective, but isn't that an example of how the current system can be used for change?
Yeah, I suppose on the margin, it's a bit of window dressing, would be my cynical response. I don't think it's they're catering to public perception rather than fundamental change, would be my reaction.
We've got another question from the floor.
Oh, hi, my name's Philip Lobley, and I have a small winery over in Glenburn. And small, it is very small. My question to the panel is, in terms of the numbers of farmers currently farming in Australia, it's a declining number compared to, say, the 30s, 40s and 50s, where most people in the city would have had known of a farmer or a farming family. Today, that's less and less the case. So what's the panel's thoughts on, you know, reconnecting people more directly with farmers, having more farmers on the land? And Sharman, you pointed out that it costs $5 million to establish a dairy. Now, that's sort of a disincentive to many to go back onto the land. Do we need smaller farms and more of them, supplying more locally? I think that generally would be the message. So, yes, what's the panel's thoughts on that?
I wouldn't mind talking about rebranding farming a bit. I mean, farming... I mean, if you think about the being a dairy farmer, a good example, you know, it's bloody hard work. You don't really get paid a lot of money. No one really cares where their milk comes from. It's this kind of, you know, that's the perception. So the more that people appreciate the labour that is involved, because that's, I mean, farming fundamentally comes down to an input of time and energy to produce something that feeds someone. So the more that people appreciate where that comes from, and the more that that the media, any form of communication that can talk about the value of farming, the value of family farms, the value of food, we do need to regenerate the culture within young people, the value of farming as a practice. You know, the agricultural colleges are not closing because governments are shutting them down. It's because young people don't want to study to be farmers. You know, that's a big issue. And it sort of seems to be shifting a bit. I mean, that kind of the resurgence of food awareness, farmers markets, all that stuff makes it... I mean, Matt's a good example. You know, young people can have good lives as farmers, and we need to promote that as a big part of that solution.
Can I add a bit in there?
Yeah, Sharman Stone.
I think we need to look at where you have thriving farmer communities, I guess, or populations. And I often compare us with New Zealand because they have, I think, a more successful agribusiness system over there, particularly in their sheep meat, their wool, their dairying, and their fruit growing, and their superb marketers as well. But one of the things they've got over there is very successful agribusiness leadership, which you don't have in Australia. Our various industries are fractured. The a primary producer is ultimately and absolutely an independent operator, and they tend to see themselves in competition with all of their neighbours. So if your piggery gets a terrible disease, well, that's good because I'll get better in my market today. But our problem in Australia too is the fact that if you look at any other developed country in the world, there's a recognition that agribusiness is such high risk, high cost, and that strategically it is such an important industry for whatever country, whether you're talking Japan, Korea, US, Canada. There is extraordinary support for those agribusinesses in those countries, whether it's in R&D, whether it's in tax breaks, whether it's in education and information, or giving them back what they pay in export fees and charges. There's a whole range of supports which they acknowledge in other countries, like UK. The government has just brought in a new ruling saying government procurement of food for all of their government agencies, hospitals, mental institutions, prisons, they'll encourage that procurement to be from British foods first and foremost. All of that is government recognition of the importance of the sector and the fact it does need, I won't use the subsidy words, I'll use the S word though, support. And it's not because we're on our knees and hopeless, it's because the risks and the costs are so great in food production, good food production, that you often can't do it alone.
Now, we'll only have time for a handful more questions from the floor, so we'll take this one here, then I'd like to hear from a couple of people we haven't heard from as yet.
Hi, it's Thea from the Youth Food Movement again. In the past couple of months, we've seen a really beautiful story come out of France where a supermarket there has actually begun stocking what we call ugly produce, so ugly fruit and vegetables. I'm really interested in what the panel think about whether this is a viable story that we can bring to Australia, and if it is, what impact that can have on farmers.
Matt, can I get you to answer that? You talk to your consumers, your shoppers all the time. How much... How willing are people to buy the inglorious fruit, I think they were called in France, weren't they? Inglorious fruit and vegetables.
Well, our mob get all our inglorious fruit and they pay the price for it. It's we don't even give a discount for stuff that's got a carrot with two legs is great as far as we're concerned. I think as long as you're talking to your customers and they realise that there's the quality's there and it's not actually, it's just a cosmetic thing, no one actually cares. And that French story sort of backed that up, I think.
We covered that on the program and it was one of the most popular stories we've had in a long time. So, Carol Richards, why, if there's this desire or willingness to eat the ugly fruit and veg out there, is it not stocked in the big supermarkets?
Yeah, I want to go back to Christine's point earlier, is that the major supermarket chains, big corporations acting like governments. So what's happening in, we're talking about food regulation, we used to have the government very much involved in food safety, food regulation. After the Metworth crisis that was mentioned before, the food regulatory regime shifted in favour of the supermarkets and their private standards. So they were asked to govern, and they do govern the supply chain. So they set their private standards around things like food safety, based on government minimum standards anyway, but they're governing around food safety, but they're also governing around the quality, what they term quality, which we might term cosmetic appearance of food. So there's very strict regimes between the supermarket chains and the producers of the types of food that will be accepted into those stores. And all the costs, the externalities, are passed back to the growers. So there's no incentive at the moment for the supermarkets to take cosmetically imperfect food.
You cop it as a supplier.
Can I add, why are we allowing the major supermarket chains to govern outside of their corporation? They're acting like governments, they're governing other people, but we never democratically elected them to govern, but they're governing the food supply chain and they're making a big impact on the types of food that we're eating.
But they have the right to specify what they want to buy.
And they're 80%, if you don't sell to them and you grow 50 tonnes of carrots, where else do you go? It's a lot of farmers' markets.
Let's get a question from the front row here.
Hi, my name's Kirsten. I'm from the Open Food Network and the Australian Food Hubs Network. I just had a couple of things to say. There's been a lot of talk about pricing and supermarkets. We've had a couple of things happen recently. One, I had a student who went around and looked at fruit and vegetable prices in supermarkets, greengrocers, etc., in inner suburban, middle suburban, outer suburban, found consistently more affordable at independent greengrocers than supermarkets. Just this week, we run an organisation called the Southeast Food Hub operating in a growth area in Casey, Cardinia. One of our buying group coordinators took it upon herself to go and compare the prices and found that only potatoes and onions were in fact cheaper at Woolworths in Cranbourne than the Southeast Food Hub, and over 80% of our lines were certified organic. So I think the critical thing about this is when we're talking about how we change supply chains and how we get transparency in supply chains, there's a world of difference between the supermarkets and buying directly from the farmer. The critical thing is all of the diverse, independent, creative stuff that happens in the middle that keeps money in local economies. So we have a particular passion about, look, this is not about we've got to get rid of the middlemen. This is about we need smart, ethical, transparent middlemen of all kinds of shapes and sizes and farmers working together and buyers working together, etc. So that's the kind of work that we're trying to do, is make it easier for these diverse local economies to actually exist. So I think it's just really important to keep that in mind. It's like, it's not about getting rid of the middlemen, it's about enabling that to happen in all sorts of different ways. Okay. So I guess the critical question there is kind of going back to how do we start to change this conversation or develop a more sophisticated or smarter understanding of the fact that it's actually distribution systems that are going to make the difference in how we provide fair prices to farmers and fair prices to eaters.
Ewan, you wanted to talk to that? I should mention that what you're hearing there is the rain coming down. It started to rain quite heavily.
Good old rain in Collingwood. Look, I think the convenience is a really important thing to think about. You know, what supermarkets provide fundamentally is, yes, there's the price. Whether the price is better or worse, I don't think a lot of people actually have the time to compare the price. It's just the convenience. So convenience plus price equals I go there. And that's, I mean, part of the convenience issue needs to be, I mean, we need to be realistic. If it's independent supply chains, if it's alternative supply chains, if it's direct from the farmer, if it's farmers markets, I mean, it is a bit, it's a bit crap that farmers markets are only on one day of the week. You know, I mean, the reality is that that you have to pack up your kids, go there, if it's raining, whatever, you know. So it is, part of the solution is in people coming up with better ways to fulfill that need, which is, so the business model needs to be find ways of providing convenience, and then maybe we can have a better scenario for a lot of people.
Can we just rush through a last couple? We'll get the question there, and then there's the lady next to you, and then the last one perhaps over there, and we'll wrap up after that. So,
hi, my name's Diana. I'm a concerned resident of Melbourne, and I volunteer for cultivating community. I collect food waste from cafes and compost it in the local area. It's a great grassroots initiative, but I feel that there are some large structural issues that are best addressed through top-down leadership, which we're not receiving at the moment. Question for Sharman, what are the three most pressing things that you would ask consumers to pressure our government in doing in terms of improving the situation for our small food producers and preventing some of the issues we have with the supermarkets at the moment?
Yeah, I think we've got to get our competition policy sorted out. It's failed us over many years now, and until we do get competition policy completely sorted, we're going to see monopolies like we've got, duopolies continuing on, which makes it very difficult for a small producer. You know, if you want to produce a new honey for Coles or Woolies, they say, oh great, we'll have 14 tonnes a week now for the next, and they don't have 14 tonnes a week, so they can't do it, and there's no other outlet except the health food store around the corner, and that's not enough to survive. So I think we've got to get the competition policy right. I want the labelling laws sorted urgently, immediately. It's completely in the government's bailiwick to do that. Thirdly, I want our anti-dumping regime to be sorted, because as long as this cheap, dirty junk is coming in from overseas, it's knocking out, it's putting the floor price in the supermarkets for Australian product so low that they're at subsistence level economically, so many of our producers. That's not fair. That's not right. That's why the next generation of farmers are saying, forget it. We'll go and be accountants.
Can we just get this lady at the back there been waiting to ask a question? Can we take that from the floor?
Hi there. My name's Kelly. I'm a lecturer at William Angliss in gastronomy, and I'm a PhD student at Melbourne Uni. And I'm sort of interested in the relationship between the culinary and the agricultural. I'm wondering, as a teacher and as a researcher, maybe Carol or Christine can comment on whether the sort of privatisation that we're seeing of the university sector and some of the plans for the university sector in the future in Australia is going to affect the ability for researchers to do good independent research in sustainable food and agriculture. I'm thinking, you know, ARC grants, that sort of stuff coming from perhaps the social sciences rather than the sciences. What are your sort of thoughts on that?
Yes. Actually, yes, we were actually just talking about that before, how much pressure we're under to get funding for our research through private sources rather than through government sources, because there's less and less government sources for funding of independent critical research or research supporting new technologies, new management systems, new investment in new skills, and the ARC, Australian Research Council funding, which is the major source for major research projects. I do happen to know that there's been very few food studies projects ever supported through that program.
Can I, Carol, I just add, I was recently invited to put in a bid with a consortium, a collaborative research centre on safe and saved foods, and a group of us had got together. I think $1 million had already been invested in this would be a big bid, about $30 million, and we all had our tickets for a meeting in Melbourne, and the federal budget just cut that completely. The 19th round of the CRC bids was just completely, the rug was pulled from under us. So that was going to be on safe and saved food, about food waste. So particularly there was a big budget cut in terms of independent research on food. So we're constantly seeing a squeeze on research funding and pressure from the university to seek partnerships with industry. And it's very hard probably for, I don't know, I'll speak for myself here, it might be very hard for me to approach Coles and Woolworths and ask for research to critique their supermarket power. I'm not sure if they're going to buy that. And if they did, I think I wouldn't accept their money either.
Look, a final comment or question from Tammy at the back, and then we'll have to wrap up.
Thanks for indulging me, Cameron. I'm going to actually just throw out a final provocation, and that is that everyone here who's here to hear about supermarket power and is worried about supermarket power clearly has the capacity to not spend your dollars at the supermarket. And so you've got an IGA, you've got fruit shops, you've got butchers, you've got loads of options if you're in this room at very least. And I broke up with the supermarket, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm going to recommend that you do the same. And it's not that hard. You can get your toilet paper from the IGA at a bare minimum. Everyone says, but toilet paper, IGA.
Probably not a bad note to leave it on, but I do want to get a couple of just final comments from the panel, if I could. Matt Perbert, your take-home message to anyone who's, say, considering going into agriculture or food production or involved in the industry and not happy with where they're at, what would your message be to them?
Well, just choose what you want to do. We definitely need those smaller retailers. We definitely need those, you know, the butchers back. We need the bakeries back. We need the greengrocers back. And as well, we just need small farmers. Lots and lots of small farmers are going to do just as good a job and much better, I'd say, in a much more regenerative or sustainable way than any big corporation farm will do. So I think just get on the land, choose what you want to do and do it. But, I mean, don't just quit your job and head off into the bush and try and grow something. You know, start to support these institutions that do teach people how to grow and or go and help out at a farm or something like that and start to learn.
Carol, what did your message say to shoppers, consumers?
Consumers, wow. Stop thinking of yourself as a consumer. Start to think of yourself as a food citizen or an eater would be one way. Educate yourself about... Oh, thank you. Who hasn't got access to Google now? I think we do need to educate ourselves. We need to know more about the horror stories of food. I know we need to put a positive spin on the food system, but to actually know about some of the animal welfare issues, we need to know about farm debt, the impacts of farmers, farm suicides, all of those things we need to educate ourselves about now and make a stand, change.
Sharman, I'll take your message on dumping as your final comment, if that's all right.
Can I add one more? I think we need to become very serious about looking at the fact that Australia has very minimal arable soils, very finite water resources, and if we just keep allowing urbanisation to go into any old area it likes, or allow coal seam gas exploration in any old part of the country without evaluating what are we losing... Can we go for 5 years worth of gas versus 500 years worth of food production? We've got to start getting serious about the options in this country and not think importing the processed food from Singapore is the answer.
Charlie Massey, your take-home message from tonight?
I guess four words, healthy food off healthy landscapes. I think we can take the veil off information on nutrient food density and poisons in our current food. Then the power of individuals to make choices and the way they grow the food and the way they buy and just change a whole food culture is enormous.
I'll finish with you, Ewan, Director of the Field Institute. You put the event on tonight. What would you like the audience here to take away with them?
Oh, I think that the reason we do this stuff is so that we can see more of it happen. So we need more dialogue around issues like this, because only through being more informed can people make better, more informed choices. So, I mean, I think our message really is that the people who have expertise and knowledge need to be a little bit better about communicating that stuff in ways that are understandable to average people. And through that, you create a movement.
Well, plenty to think about after tonight's discussion. It's been a special edition of Bush Telegraph on RN. My thanks to the Field Institute for putting the event on. Thank you to you for turning out tonight. And, of course, thank you to the panel. Charlie Massey, farmer from the Monaro region of New South Wales, author, researcher at ANU. Ewan McEwan, director of the Field Institute. Dr. Sharman Stone, federal Liberal member for Murray. Dr. Carol Richards from QUT and the vice president of the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance. Professor Christine Parker from Monash University, who teaches business regulation and lawyer ethics, and Matt Perbrick from Grown and Gather. Could you show your appreciation for the panel? And that's Bush Telegraph for today. If you've got a view on anything that you've just heard, you can share that on the Bush Telegraph Facebook page or Twitter at RNBushTelly. Stay on RN, news is for you next.